Welcome to the Alpha Podcast by Canis, Ryan Eifert. I'll be hosting professionals that live the Alpha lifestyle from a number of different industries and career fields. You can find us at your favorite podcast apps and sign up on our newsletter for updates. Today, we've got Anthony Collins, you go by Thosh, on the podcast, and we're super excited to have you. So welcome, first of all, and thanks for being on board.
Yeah, man. Thanks a lot. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you to the whole Canis team for having me on and even having me a part of the team, man. It's been such an honor to be a part, you know, of the team here. And just, you know, get a little background info real quick. You know, I first discovered Canis and, you know, I think it was an Instagram ad, and, you know, I liked the camo pattern, and I looked up the website, and I just loved the whole narrative, the being the alpha, and you know, the whole pursuit that you guys were putting forth in the narrative. It just really spoke to me, and I just like, I gotta order a piece, and I gotta try it out. So I started off with the shirt, the Team Merino shirt, and, you know, and just kept going and adding my kit. And by the end of, you know, mid 2020, I had a full kit, you know. So it's been awesome to finally, you know, get on board with you guys in that way. So thank you.
Well, it's pretty awesome. You know, the whole idea behind the podcast, when we found you, I started following you, your Instagram account, I believe. And, you know, you go to war with your body every day on there. And that's exactly why we want to start the podcast. You know, there's people that have stories to be told, and that's exactly what we're looking for in the Alpha lifestyle. People who get up and get after it every single day of their lives. And there's a lot of days I'm sure you don't want to, and we'll get into that on this call. But you fight through it. And so, tell us a little background. So you're from Tempe, Arizona. We spoke briefly before, and go ahead and let's jump into that.
Yeah. Well, I was born and raised on the Salt River Pima Maricopa community. It's a small reservation. We're bordered up with the city of Phoenix. So our original name was the Onokamere Ta'o'atam, the Salt River people, because we lived along the Salt River. And the Salt River today is one of the major sources of water for the entire Phoenix metropolitan area. So that's on my dad's side, my paternal side. My maternal side, my mom's actually from Oklahoma, not far from you guys. She's from Pawhuska, also Seneca Cayuga, out there in Miami, Oklahoma. And so, it's some of my roots are right near, you know, where Canis was started. So that's who I am. And I was born and raised on the reservation. I lived in San Francisco for a while. Went to college there for a little bit, moved out to Los Angeles. I also worked there for a little bit. And then I came back to the community, which was always my goal. My plan was to always come back to my community. I came back in 2011, and that's what I heard a lot growing up from our elders, from my family, our knowledge keepers. They said, always come back to your community and give back for what you learned. And that was my goal. And so today I work in Indigenous wellness alongside my wife. We have an Indigenous wellness initiative that's called Well for Culture. And I also sit on the board of a nonprofit called the Native Wellness Institute. And they've been around for 20 years. I used to attend their functions as a teenager. So now I sit on the board. And so that's what our work is today. Our work is largely focused on the contributing to the healing movement that is happening throughout Native country here in the United States, as well as First Nations people in Canada. And it's really a worldwide movement of Indigenous people to reclaim our culture and identity. And hunting is a big part of that. And it's a big part of that. So that's what I love to discuss today. I grew up hunting. You know, I started, you know, hunting rabbits with my dad when I was 6, 7, javelina, mule deer, quails, dove, everything. And so that's one thing I'm really grateful for, is to have that upbringing. My dad, you know, started me and my brothers hunting when we were, yeah, 5, 6, you know. I'm going to be 40 next year. So I'm just really grateful to have that upbringing. But that's a little bit about myself for sure. Yeah.
And it's pretty awesome. And that's a pretty good segue into one of the questions I want to ask you. But what I'm fascinated with, since I've been hunting, been involved in Canis, and then even on the podcast, you know, here you and I have never met until Canis. And we both grew up and hunting rabbits and squirrels, and that's how we started. And that's, I'll be 40 next year as well. And so you've got two guys that have never met, you know, across the U.S., that we grew up with the same lifestyle, And here we are today, and hunting has become of a, in essence, a holistic piece of our lifestyle. It motivates us to stay in shape. We're you know, aspire to teach our children to hunt, and that's pretty cool, you know. And it's, no matter where I've been around the world, you know, we talk about that in our videos. We talk about it on the podcast. It's so cool. You go hunt with guys who are guides in a foreign country, and they don't even speak the same language, but you find a way to communicate because you probably both grew up hunting rabbits, squirrels, the small game, and you're hunters. And that's pretty cool. It's like this unspoken language that you just figure it out. And you think back to a long time ago, today it's changed, right? We have a lot of niceties in the world where we have grocery stores. But you think back many, many moons ago, you're definitely going to learn to communicate because you've got to eat and you're going to find a way to get it done. So I've got, this is something new, Thosh. They did a Q&A on our Instagram, and we've given some customers the opportunity, or people who follow us, the opportunity to ask some questions. And so we're going to start doing this with each podcast guest. And it's funny because the first question here that I have on the list is from Nick Mendoza: going on my first rifle elk hunt in Northern Arizona, any pointers? I was like, I think I'll have to let Thosh answer that one. that's your area.
Yeah. You know, I don't have too much experience hunting elk actually in Northern Arizona. So I wouldn't be able to, you know, give him too much from an authentic standpoint. But, I actually have a cow tag myself for archery late season up in Northern Arizona, unit 10. So that's, I've been really just, you know, pounding at it with the compound bow as much as I can. But I would love to answer that question, but you know, I'm probably in the same boat. You know, I am bringing some experienced elk hunters with me, and my dad, you know, hunted. I'd been on a couple of small elk hunts when I was younger, but nothing in the recent years. In Arizona, it's so competitive. It's hard to get an elk tag these days. So is mule deer tag as well. It's gotten so difficult in this past 10 years.
When's the rifle season in Northern Arizona?
I think some of it might start late rut, like late September.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've hunted in New Mexico, but not in Arizona. One thing that, Nick, I don't know when you're going, but when I started elk hunting, I'd always hunted with a bow during the rut. And when I went out to New Mexico, it was actually a reservation hunt. I was blown away because I grew up hunting whitetail and they're so spooky. And I didn't realize, I'd gotten accustomed to hunting elk only in the rut, and I could get close with my bow. And these elk were spooking way out there. Anytime the wind changed, or they could even get visual on you, they were acting like whitetail. The next question from Grady Rawls: Ryan, what's your next adventure? We're actually headed out to Kyrgyzstan in October, first part of October. We're going to be hunting and filming mid-Asian ibex and Argali. So that's it's a place that I've always wanted to go. I saw a hunt one time. Mike Babcock was actually on that hunt, ex-coach of the Red Wings, and I was in my living room. I'll never forget the scenery. The rivers were just blue and crystal clear, and the mountains were unbelievable, and it was a horseback hunt, and I love horses, and I love horseback hunts, so this is one that, man, I'm super excited about. Next question is Canis: gear tips for the waterfowl guys out there. You know, it's a layering system. I would say our three-quarter bottoms, the down, the tar merino, and the chamois bottoms are awesome underneath waders, because I think everybody gets tired of everything bunching up down around your ankles when you're waterfowling. And I grew up in Arkansas wearing super heavy clothing before we had technical outerwear. And I had some long walks into the blind, and I remember like almost dying of heat stroke before I got there. Our stuff's super lightweight. You can basically put it almost in your, you probably stuff it in your blind bag. And if you've got a long walk in, and then layer up from everything from the base layers to the down, to the rain gear for your three layer to keep you windproof and waterproof. Last question from Raining Red: will there be some quieter canis for the whitetail stand? We're definitely looking at some different pieces that are whitetail specific. I mean, that's my passion. That's what I grew up doing. I will tell you this: for 2 years when we prototyped Canis, I've got four kids, and I had my two boys in the stand, in a ladder stand, in sub-freezing temps where fabric tends to get loud. and I wore our rain gear over all of our insulation pieces, like a big puffy, because it's super quiet. And I had deer testing it and went to full draw numerous times with two children in the stand to see if those deer would spook, and they never spooked. So obviously early season, the merino and the fleece products are super quiet. When it gets to late season, throw your rain gear on over your insulation pieces, and that's going to make you very quiet. But yes, in the future, actually right now, we are working on whitetail specific prototypes. So
I want to speak to the Premier jacket, insulation jacket, in that regard, because, you know, in Arizona last year, 2020, we had this drought, you know, horrible drought. It was horrible for hunting. I only made two harvests last year, mule deer. That's primarily what I hunt. And on the reservation, we kind of hunt, you know, when we need to. Anyways, it was December, and it was probably about like 10 a.m. and it was already late 80s. And in the morning, it was really cold. In the morning, it was late 30s. My hands are frozen, but the jacket kept me nice and warm. I made my way up, you know, my some of my routes. And as it started getting warmer, the jacket, I didn't notice how warm it was until, you know, I realized, I looked at the temperature and I said, oh man, it's, you know, 87 degrees. And I got this Premier insulation jacket. It kept me nice and warm in the cold part. And then in this next phase, it kept me cool. So I decided to take it off, and I'm kind of being loud because I hadn't seen nothing. And, you know, I'm kind of like in this valley, and above me about, you know, 300, 400 yards, I just noticed this group of doe sitting there, which in the Sonoran Desert during a drought, when you even just see doe, you get excited, you know? And so I noticed it as I was taking the jacket off. I'm taking the jacket off. It's rustling around. It's still pretty quiet. And they do, they must have saw my movement. So I froze. And then, you know, you're playing that game and just seeing who can stay still the longest. Finally, they go back to eating, and I continue to take the jacket off. But the jacket was quiet, and I think that, you know, they saw me, because that was kind of, you know, they saw me, but, you know, I'm sure
they didn't spook from the sound.
You didn't get spooked from the sound, you know?
Yeah. Hey, some of you guys just need to be quieter when you stand. You know, I'm just going to give you that advice. Some of you guys move around too much. Well, hey, Paul Huska, Oklahoma. I actually, my bird dog went to training with Ronnie Smith Kennels, who's now in Paul Huska, Oklahoma. So I've been to Paul Huska two or three times, man. That's beautiful country. I'd love to, I mean, rolling hills. I took my kids with me, and they're like, Dad, we need to get some hunting land over here near Paul Huska. So small world. But tell me, so your dad got you into hunting, as a small boy, and, you know, talk a little bit about that and how he inspired you to get into hunting and taught you how to hunt, and what hunting means to you now.
Yeah, absolutely. When we first, I think I remember first being on hunts like about six. My dad has lots of photos of us. My dad was really, he always had a camera. He always had a 35 millimeter Yashica, and he was always taking pictures of us out on our hikes, on our hunts, you know, family trips. And so we have a ton of photos. I'm grateful for that from back when we were that age. I just posted one on my Instagram. It was 17 years ago from last week. We harvested a 3x2 mule deer here on the res, and we had a picture posing together, me, my dad, and my brother. I believe I was 9 years old or something at that time. Or anyways, we have tons of great photographs from our childhood, and that's something that's one of my most memorable experiences as a child, is out hunting rabbits with the 22, is sometimes with the bow. You know, we shot everything from a long bow to recurve to a compound. I used to shoot a Hoyt compound when I was like 14. And so, you know, we started then. We would also take trips up to the rim, the Mogollon Rim in northern Arizona. We'd go up there and hunt squirrel. We hunted javelina. Javelina was the first, what's considered big game here in Arizona. Javelina, that was the first big game I had harvested. I was probably, yeah, 10 or 12. And my dad made it a point to take us out to hunt the land right there on our community. We hunted all of the animals that our ancestors have been hunting for tens of thousands of years. And part of the protocols of young boys in the original pre-colonial days, the young boys before they came of puberty age, they would start making their bows, and they would start to learn to hunt small games such as the thob, the cottontail rabbit, or the chuv, which is the jackrabbit. They would learn to hunt that, and they would use their furs. And then when they start to coming of age, then that's they would go out to hunt the bigger game, such as the mule deer and such. The mule deer hunting and using the antlers of the mule deer and the head was actually part of our boys' coming of age ceremony. And so they all these animals have of have this historic spiritual significance in our culture. So they provide, of course, nourishment, but they also have each of them represent different things. And so for us, to continue to have a relationship with these animals, to continue to hunt them and have respect and honor them is continuing with our original way. And so I believe that was my dad's intention when he first started taking us out on hunts, and then he would get a tag and we'd go on the stateside, we'd go out and be on camps and in hunts there. And for me, it was him teaching us how to connect with the land. It's maintaining our heimadug, which means your way of life, and in continuing to our establish our relationships with those animals and to be able to provide for our family. Because I remember that a lot growing up, on our reservation in the late 80s, early 90s. My dad was the only one that worked, and there was a household of like sometimes 8 to 9 of us when my half brothers and sisters would come and live with us at different times. So hunting and quails, rabbit, all that, squirrel, javelina, mule deer, those were I remember eating that a lot growing up until I moved away. And then when I moved away to California, hunting kind of left me for a little bit. And I think maybe I kind of felt that during those times in my life. It's when I got off of a walking in a good path, and then when I came back home is when I got back on to continue my hunting journey. So today, for me to do that today is again, it's to continue to uphold my relationship to the land, because I believe that when we go out to forage the land, or when we plant the indigenous seeds of our people, and we eat those fruits from that, and then we go out to hunt, we are integrating ourselves with the land. I believe that that's how we are spiritually aligning ourselves with the very land in which we live upon, or the land that our ancestors had walked for thousands of years. So to me, it's a spiritual thing as well as a practical, in the sense that we're providing nourishment, right? As we all know, hunting provides the most ethically sourced, eco-friendly, naturally organic, nourishing for meat, the best protein, right? And we know that it's one of the most important nutrients that we can get is protein, since it's the building blocks of our cells. So I look at it as providing that nourishment to my two daughters, my wife, and you probably feel the same when your children, are eating your harvest and getting their nourishment. To me, I just feel so, I feel like I'm providing, I'm really being the most that I can be as a father, as a provider. It gives me more purpose in my life. And so that's just a little bit about it for me.
I got tickled at the dinner table the other night. My 8-year-old daughter. I was like, okay, I've obviously achieved one side of the mission here, but I need to continue educating. We're having dinner, and I cooked a ribeye steak, and she said, "Dad, did you kill this?" And I said, "No, not this." And she said, "Where does this come from?" I said, "What do you mean? It comes from a cow." And she's like, "Oh, I thought it was deer or elk or something." And I was like, "So it's pretty funny. It's they've gotten so used to us eating things at the house that we've gone out and hunted." She was asking where the beef came from. I said, "That came from the grocery store."
That's when you know you're winning in
That's right.
parenting, is when your children are asking, they're mindfully asking. They want to know, where did this animal come from? It gave its life. Who harvested it? Where did it come from?
Absolutely.
That's when you know you're winning.
Absolutely. When we had fish one night, she said, "Where did you catch this?" And I was like, "We're on the right track here." Listening to you talk, and as I've talked to, other hunters in the community, like just listening to you talk, it reminds me of when I was a child out hunting myself. And not to get into the question that people ask you sometimes, why do you hunt? But I think, you mentioned becoming at one with the land. And when my dad and my grandfather would take me out to hunt, thinking back, there's no other reason that that me at 12 or 13 years old, that I would have been in the woods at 5:30 in the morning in sub-freezing temperatures, right, sitting out there. I was out there hunting whitetail deer. Because I was out there, that taught me to fall in love. And from a very young age, you know, I mean, that's when I really got to sit by myself and start shooting by myself. And of course, that was a whole nother topic. This empowerment of, I'm 13, I'm in the wilderness, my dad trusts me now, kind of feel like becoming a man. He trusts me to sit here by myself with a 30-30 lever action rifle. And then you start taking in the sights and the sounds, and it's just majestic, you know, and then the frost starts melting, and it's, that's when it was really became spiritual for me and really became my passion. You know, it's like, I couldn't wait. I remember, you know, when I, in high school, when I started playing football, every once in a while we'd have film on Saturdays, and I'm like, ah, oh, I don't want to do film on Saturday. I need to be in the woods, you know, hunting season's open. And so and then as you know, these trips that we've taken, or that other people take around the world, it's that, right? It's like, if that opportunity comes along for you to be able to go do that, it's like, we've done that here in the US, whether you're, you know, growing up hunting in the desert or like us here hunting oak flats in Arkansas in the whitetail woods, that's because we become one with the land and we're very spiritual about that. And so to have the opportunity to go to, whether it's in the US or abroad, it's so cool to see other people's culture and the way they hunt and those, and the way those animals behave. That's what it's all about.
Yeah. And you know, that's kind of, what you were saying earlier, you know, that resonates with me too, is the hunting culture around the entire world. Like you said earlier, you could not speak the same language or have the same cultural or religious upbringing, or you could be of a different, you know, political organization and subscribe to these different ideas. But hunting is really one of those, these old, age-old traditions that humans been doing since time immemorial that we're able to connect on, because it's again, like you say, it is a way for us to connect to that land there, to have honor and respect for the animals, and to provide ourselves nourishment and know where it's coming from, right? Isn't there empowerment when you know, when you're sitting down at the table and you're eating backstrap from that whitetail, you can think about the experience, you know, of sitting in the tree stand or whatever, however it is you hunted, and the work that it goes into, and just the gratitude that happens as you eat and you're thinking about that. And I think some people who don't hunt may not understand that. They think, oh, how morbid, why would you think about that while you're eating food? But you have to experience it yourself, right, in order to truly appreciate that.
You know, yeah, it's my son, and I don't know if I've talked about this before on the podcast, but growing up hunting whitetail in Arkansas, when you shoot whitetail, you basically, you know, you can gut them and you can get them to the truck or the ATV or something. And we've got processors, because the season's big, you know, people can make a living out of processing your animal for you. And so the first time that I went elk hunting and the elk's down, it's like, it's a different deal. Like, I've never done this before, you know, and I was older. And so, when my son was, I think he was 10, he shot a doe, and I said, okay, you got to quarter him out. I'm going to teach you how to do that. And so we practice on whitetail on the ground. And I said, because someday, hopefully you have the opportunity to go on a mountain hunt like you guys grew up doing, and you're not going to be in the same situation that I was in. You're going to know how to quarter that animal out, and you can practice until you get old enough to go elk hunting or mule deer hunting, and you've got to backpack that animal out.
That's what yeah, absolutely. And that's good teaching. That's important for him to know right away. And that's how we grew up doing it. We'd be, you know, pretty far in the mountains. Not too far. I hear about people packing out, you know, elk 10, 12 miles. That's pretty beastly. You know, I'd love to get into that one day, but we've been really fortunate in the sense that we've probably been, you know, 4 or 5 miles at the most, but you're going up and down this rough Sonoran terrain. And I remember, you know, carrying a pack and my dad put a hindquarter in there wrapped up in a game bag, and, you know, me and my brothers be struggling up the hill or whatever, or sliding down the hills, you know. To me, that's one of my favorite parts of the hunt is breaking down and quartering up and then getting him in my caribou bags and getting it, you know, cinched down in the Mystery Ranch pack. And I love the challenge of getting that out back to the truck. I mean, to me, and I think to myself, this is why I train. This is why you get in and I train and do functional training and fitness, because I want to be able to do this. And I want to be able to do this for a long time.
It's like a circular process, right? So the hunting leads us to the physical lifestyle of wellness, because I was actually on that hunt in New Mexico the guy that I was with, there was a situation where it got super steep and he had a little sensitivity to heights. And so I had a quarter on my shoulder. It started snowing. So we didn't have time to skin that one out before the snow came in. So I had a quarter on my shoulder and I had another quarter in my pack. And fortunately there were some areas where we could slide a little bit, but I got about 20 yards from the ATV and I dropped to both knees and just vomited because I was so physically exhausted from carrying that weight. And it's like, when I saw the ATV, I knew, okay, we're here, we've made it, mission accomplished, I can load it up. And I lost it. So, it's a circular pattern that I love that helps us stay in shape and it gives us something to train for. Right?
Absolutely. You know, I think about that all the time. I think about that circular pattern you're talking about. I think about the element of eating the food. I think about, you know, I'm eating well from my harvest so I can train well, but I'm training so I can go out and harvest some more as well as other things. And it goes in this circular thing. And to me, that's what a human way of life is today in our world today. I think that that's one of the closest things amongst other things that we can do to maintain our human way, you know?
Absolutely. You know, and that's what, let's kind of segue into, you know, the world's in a weird place right now, right? And obviously that's a whole nother conversation for another day, but I think how it's applicable here, you know, I believe everybody wakes up every day and has a choice, right? You have a choice to proactively live your life and create change for yourself, for other people. You know, I think today a lot of people sit around feeling sorry for themselves. And I want to segue that into what you're doing, you know, your background. You know, I've been studied. I've been on some of those reservations, you know, in the brief time that you and I talked, I know that this is personal to you and you've had some family go through some struggles. And I look at your Instagram account talking to you, man, it's motivating. Like, you motivate me. And I think, I'm sure you're the same way. I mean, there's days where I'm tired. It's like your body's broken down. You're just tired. You know, we've got kids, the hustle and bustle of life. And you're like, man, it'd be easier just to skip that workout. And you open your buddy's account and it's like, no, Thosh is out there hammering. I'm going to go hammer it, you know, or a Cameron Haynes or whoever that may be. But you proactively make a choice every day and you live that lifestyle and you also give back to your people. And so let's talk about that and how you got involved and what you're doing and how you're trying to basically help people.
Yeah, our work, the work that we do today, my wife and I started an Indigenous Wellness Initiative. We started working on it in 2013 and we kind of played around with it for a little bit. Then we started releasing our work online and offering workshops in 2015. But before that as well, I started working with the Native Wellness Institute about 10, 11 years ago. And what the Native Wellness Institute does is, again, it's contributing to the worldwide Indigenous movement to reclaim our total health and well-being. So our spiritual, physical, mental, and emotional well-being. Much of this work in the United States, as far as Native people here, it sort of started after civil rights movement, when Indigenous people on the reservations realized that the policies the federal government had set forth for us was not working for us, and that it was contributing to social inequality that resulted in health disparities. So it's important to acknowledge the legacy of American colonialism that continues actually persists today in many forms. It's important to acknowledge that legacy because that is the reason why so many of our Indigenous people in our communities have been disenfranchised, have been disempowered by being taken off of the land that our ancestors had inhabited for, you know, tens of thousands of years since creation, and put on small reservation where we've been prohibited from hunting, from planting and foraging. And yeah, at some point in time throughout different parts of the history in America, Indigenous people, Native Americans, were become largely dependent on government subsidy of food programs, white flour, iodized salt, refined sugar, hydrogenated oils, alcohol, many different types of foods that processed foods that our people never, eaten. They didn't come from the land. And so a loss of the river, like where I come from, the river was virtually dried up in the late 1800s. And what that did is people were no longer able to farm. They were no longer able to farm the way they did in pre-colonial times. And as a result, being dependent upon government food subsidy, diabetes became one of the prevalent diseases of modernity. So diseases such as diabetes type 2, cardiovascular disease, cancer, neurodegenerative, and then anxiety and addiction. Those are all new diseases that as Native Americans, we were virtually non-existent. These are diseases that emerge when people have been removed from their land, when punished for speaking the languages or forced to attend boarding schools to acculturate them into mainstream American culture. So the people and Native people in the recent decades have realized this and made this movement to heal and reclaim. And so growing up in my community, we've had I was exposed to two things, I think, in my community growing up. I was exposed to our cultural traditions, our autumn worldview, our songs, our ceremonies, our language. And then later on, we start to revitalize more of our food practices. And but at the same time, I was seeing addiction. I was seeing it affect my family, my brother and sisters, who I lost a brother in 2013 and a sister who was missing and murdered in 2006. So for myself and Chelsea as well, my wife had also experienced the same upbringing, both strong ancestral wisdom and presence from one faction of the community, but also another faction of our community suffering from addiction and things like that. So the movement, the Native wellness movement, is about restoring our original indigenous life ways, and also participating in utilizing in Western medicine as well, those applicable components. And hunting is a big part of that too. So, it's revitalizing our food ways. And it's getting people on the land. It's giving people purpose again too. So, that's a little bit about our work and the larger indigenous wellness movement.
Wow. So I just want to go back for a second if I heard that right, because I didn't know that. So you lost your brother and your sister as well was murdered.
Yeah, and in right now in the United States, and in Canada, and really all of what we call Turtle Island, which is the entire Western Hemisphere, there's a phenomenon right now known as the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, or also two-spirit relatives. And Indigenous women are at higher risk of violence perpetuated against them, sexual violence. And that's the statistics, the number is high. And so it's starting to gain traction in mainstream media. And within the Department of Secretary, Deb Haaland has put forth initiatives to bring more resources to that regard. So that's our sister is actually a victim of that phenomenon. And I encourage all non-Indigenous people to look into that and find out and educate themselves for sure. We also lost our brother in 2006, and he had a hard time where he was addicted on and off to substances, and he had a shootout with the police, and as a result of that, he lost his life there. And so for me to, experience this was something that had also put me on this path to objectively be on a healing journey and objectively participate in the healing movement within our community to reduce people's risk of following down this life way, this lifestyle path. Again, it's something that people are doing because they have been traumatized at some point in their life. They're unwell, and it's something that they don't have a control over. And that's what addiction is, right? People are out of control because of hurt.
Man, well, I'm sorry to hear that. That's pretty heavy. And I think that goes back, and that's what I admire about you. You have a choice. You have a choice that you could say this is just the way it is, and be bitter, right? At a number of reasons. I mean, you could have a circular conversation there, but you said I'm going to pick up the flag for my family, for my people, and for my children, and for the country, right? And I'm going to turn this around. Or I'm going to make damn sure that I bust my ass trying.
Absolutely. To me that, when you are at a certain state in your state of spiritual, physical, mental, emotional well-being, you do have a choice. If you're at a good place in there, you have a choice to to find out or to think about the life you want to live. And that's certainly, it's been a a teaching and a purpose that I've put myself on, and my wife as well had also made this realization right before we met. So together we take our paths and go alongside and contribute, and really trying to revitalize and evolve and heal things in that's been in our family. So our daughters have a different upbringing. So a well life is the norm even more than it was for us when we were growing up.
Absolutely. You mentioned processed food. I made a note here as well, like the processed foods, and that makes a lot of sense to me. As I've gone on my own journey, as I've changed training and really tried to listen to my body and tried to almost in layman's terms, like the old KISS principle, like keep it simple, stupid, has really helped me in my training, especially for hunting. We've talked about it a little bit on the podcast where I would see guys like just do a stair stepper or just like go run along or run up hills to try to train like for a mountain hunt. And then I would basically self-assess and come back from a hunt and say, okay, my back was hurting or my ankles were hurting. Like how can I change that? What can I do differently? Same with food, processed foods. As I've tried to change holistically the way that I eat and eat clean and basically as much as you can. Now I'll still have, the occasional pizza, right? Pizza night or whatever. But when I eat fried foods and processed oils, I can listen to my body now. And because I haven't eaten it in so long, or it's not very often that I do eat it. When I put that in my body, I can actually feel my body react. And I have an upset stomach or you have a headache, you just feel off. And so you think about that and you think, so you especially take right the Native American people and you've eaten so clean for so long and then you eat these processed foods. I mean it can wreck you. And like me personally, like I can say I've experienced that personally. I mean, you and I are the same age. Growing up, we like kind of that window when we were kids, I had a lot of processed foods. And it never affected me like it does now, but since I've gotten off of it, and then when you put some in, it's like, whoa.
Yep, absolutely. Same thing. Like I said, when I was saying my upbringing, I think the food ways and food sovereignty that we are doing today, like our family, like foraging more and farming more. We didn't do that when we were younger, and that's sort of like a thing that's been revitalized in the past decade. And we hunted though. That's one thing that never really, I think a lot of Native people really haven't stopped doing. And same thing though, when I was a kid, we drank soda, we always had chips, and of course my mom and dad, they always limited us. My dad knew, I think, my mom and dad both intuitively knew. Of course there was some education back in the 80s about, processed sugar, but it wasn't not nearly enough as it should have been, obviously. But my mom and dad would always say that. My dad would kind of have the old oral traditional stance on it. He would say, Don't eat too much of this processed stuff. Don't eat too much of candy, not too much of this. And it makes you slow. It makes you lazy. And don't sit around. Okay, you guys been sitting around watching TV. We need to get outside and do something, And so certainly for sure, we grew up, I remember going to Denny's was a big deal for me as a kid.
Absolutely.
McDonald's as well,
Denny's
was
and
like a
Waffle House.
right, Waffle House. Going to Denny's and McDonald's was a big deal. And I quit eating fast food. Like the last time I had like Burger King or something like that was back when I used to live in Los Angeles, back when I used to be a drinker. I don't drink anymore. I've been sober for about 9 years, but it's about 10 or 12 years when I the last time I had a, fast food. And I'm really proud of that. I'm actually more proud of that I haven't had fast food and soda and, over 10 years than I am being proud about quitting alcohol 9 years ago because they're so prevalent and they're so normalized, right? Processed food on. But I'm like you, I certainly love my snacks, my treats. I love to have a pizza. I love have some kind of like gummy candy. I love a caffeinated, energy drink once in a while. But I know that I have my limitations, right? I have my limitations. I have certain foods that I make an exception for that I will have, but I make sure, that I'm training all week and that I'm eating whole food mostly. I'm getting good rest. I'm not in a stressful state. Sometimes your stress does go up there and you find yourself snacking or whatever. But I think it's normal. But I think there's a healthy level of eating for some kind of reward, and I think there's a
Absolutely.
healthy level of that.
Yeah, I think you hit on sleep too. I've found that's so important. I mean, there's days where it's like I need to be at the office, at 8 o'clock, and it's like, okay, an extra 30 minutes, that's helped me looking at my sleep timer on the phone. It's like you get to where you can't function, right, without the sleep. And so it's like an extra 30 minutes actually will make you more productive, right? Getting up and getting your day going, and your day's going to be better. And that's one thing, especially if you're training hard. Like I again, listening to my body, like where you train days, you train hard and you don't get enough sleep. And it's like this snowball effect that by the end of the week, it's you're really like, I say combat ineffective in all areas, in many areas of your life, because you're just flat.
Right, absolutely. For instance, right now I'm getting more sleep because I got a broken metatarsal and on my foot. And so what I've done is to, of course, even eat more protein than what I'm already eating. But I've been getting an hour and a half sleep extra because I know that your tissue reheals and regenerates as you sleep, as you're well nourished, as well as your immune system. So that's one thing that I'm doing right now is I'm actually getting more sleep. Usually I get up at 5. Sometimes I used to get up at 5, 4:45, just so I can train before my daughters get up, before I take her to daycare. But I've been just been saving my workouts for like late morning, which is unusual for me because I like to do my training fasted. But yeah, man, the sleep is so important. We're kind of touching on we're touching on some circles that are a part of our wellness model. And there's seven circles of wellness that we found that contribute to a well life. And one of them is our relationship to food, water, being well nourished, getting healthy sleep, getting lots of movement, having some sort of a ceremony or ritual in your life that provides low stress, and then having your home or your office as a sacred space because it contributes to your wellness, and then maintaining your connection to the land through hunting, hiking, foraging, farming, all that, and then maintaining your connection to some sort of network like your family or your community that we found from our perspective as Native people that those actually contribute to, how well you are. So we're kind of touching on a lot of those. I think that's awesome.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's pretty cool when you look at and see how those all work to help each other. But let's talk. So first of all, I looked on your social media, and I saw that it looks like you broke the metatarsal. You were actually on shoes on the trail that you shouldn't have been wearing. Well, I did the same thing, and I think it was before Nepal. I was trying to remember, and I was actually running with a weighted vest, right? Just a tack vest, and it's like 23 pounds. And I saw your post. I was running in this vest. One, I ran too many days with the weight. I realized, again, listen to your body, right? I was like, I should not be running because I can't get up into my high cardio zone with the weight. And so I was like, one, I ran too many days, but also I should not have had those. They were the road shoes on the trail, but you know how we are, right? You're just like, I'll be fine. I'm tough enough. And I came down on a rock. And so I went self-diagnosed in the boot for about 2 weeks. And by the grace of God, when I got to Nepal, it worked itself out. I guess those 2 weeks in the boot, and I don't know if deep stone bruise or, a slight fracture. But so I saw your post. One, I was laughing because I've been there. And two, I was just like super motivated because I saw you. Of course, that's you. That's what I love about you. I saw your post. You got your cast on, but we're still working out. You had adversity. You said, "No, I'm not going to not work out. I'm just going to adapt, right? I'm going to adapt and overcome." And that's that alpha lifestyle. So you're sitting there in your cast, and I think you're doing shoulder presses, with the kettlebells. Is that what you were doing? Were you doing shoulder presses or
Yeah, I was
some kind of
doing,
squat
oh
press?
man, I've been doing all kinds of stuff. But yeah, to go back on the story, I was wearing On running shoes, and I generally love those shoes. But I was wearing, yep, they're made for road, they're made for going forward. But I didn't know the trail we were going on was going to be that rugged. I thought it was going to be a flat trail, but this was up and down. There was all sorts of rocks sticking out of the ground. There was ledges, and I was in the same boat as you. That's a big learning lesson for me because I had my pack on, I had my camera, and I had a little medic pack. I had a bottle of water in there, and it's probably like 12, 15 pounds, but that's enough to add a little bit more weight than you really need for a 7 mile run. Because some of the other guys are like, "Oh, you're gonna ruck it. Oh, you're taking your pack." I'm like, "Yeah, why not?" And the day before, We were doing a deadlift session, and I made my personal record of 485. We had a guy there as a buddy of mine that coached me and made these adjustments, several adjustments, and I was pulling, 485 for one rep, and I felt good, I felt good. But I could feel it on that run, my posterior. I could feel my glutes, my hams, I can feel my low back. They were fatigued. So I told myself, all right, you should not have, taken this pack. You should be walking this. And I kept going. I kept going, and I decided to actually take it easy. My shoelace kept coming undone. And it actually happened when I was just walking. I stepped off a small ledge there, and same thing. There was a rock sticking halfway out of the ground. I stepped on it, and my ankle rolled, and I heard a pop. And I was, ah, oh, damn it! And I took my shoe off, and right away there's a bump and a bruise on the outer edge of my left foot on the blade. So, and I started looking at that, and took open my little MyMedic pack, and put this cold compression on, and I put it into my shoe, and I kept trying to go and I was like, oh, there's no way I can make it. It only hurt when I put pressure on it. And I started Googling the symptoms, and it looks like a Jones fracture, a fracture of at the fifth of base of the metatarsal. I think that's what I had. I was pretty confident. But I had to walk about 8 miles on it, on the way out, and came back home and went to the hospital, and they confirmed, yeah, you got a fracture. You have to wear the boot. Wore that for a little bit, then they put me in a cast. And yeah, I started training. I said, this is not going to stop me from training, and I'm thinking to myself, if I get good healing, if I take care of myself, maybe I can make the over-the-counter deer archery season in Arizona, which is right now, and I'm not able to get out there. And but I figured, I got so much time. It's the beginning of the season. So I just started training still. I'm doing a lot of posterior training because I can put pressure on my heel on and in with off my back. In supinated position. So, I've been doing hamstring curls on a resistance band or a suspension band. I've been doing Nordic deadlift, Nordic curls, leg extensions, with the band. And of course, all the upper body pull-ups, push-ups, all that kind of stuff, overhead press, pulling motions. So I'm still getting after it. It definitely, I see this as a humbling experience, and I see this as a teachings are coming out of this. There's a teaching out of everything. Every experience, no matter how tragic it is really subjective. Our human, the human side of us that's been coddled wants to be upset and mad because I can't train. But if we shift that perspective a little bit, we see this as a teaching. What have I learned from this? What can I learn from this humbling experience? So that's the way I see it right now. Still getting after it, enjoying it.
Absolutely. Well, so my question, I guess, is, and what do you think it is inside of you that drives you to, I mean, again, the epitome of this alpha lifestyle and the sense that you overcome adversity, you just keep hammering at your workouts, you adapt, you overcome. Do you think that's a self-discovery path that you've found within yourself that's made you become who you are? Or is it teaching of somebody that's been an influence in your life? What makes you grow up and live this alpha lifestyle that you live every single day?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad that you recognize that. And going back to my upbringing, that was one thing we heard a lot from elders, from my dad, from our knowledge keepers in the community. They always talked about this concept of never take our arms, our legs, our body for granted, and to always give thanks that you have a body to move, to run, to jump, to play, because there are some people that don't have those same opportunities for whatever reason. They were born a certain way, or they had endured some, a tragic accident, and they lost the use of their limbs. So I heard that a lot. And within our culture, we are also known as runners. So we did a lot of running when we were younger. We had run for certain community causes from one location to another. And that was what we heard a lot. They always said, always move your body, never just sit too long, never eat too much. And that's that ancestral knowledge that they knew before science. So this is just from that perspective. So I've always kept that, in my mindset growing up and going forward. And I've tried to apply that to everything. And I did fall off the path for a little while. But in my adulthood, especially as becoming a family man, a husband, a father, I've really tried to live by that even more, because I'm trying to show that to my daughters to make that the norm. But that's sort of, I guess that's where that comes from, is that to me, I always think nothing is going to become an obstacle to the point where I just throw my hands in the air and say, oh, there's nothing I can do. I want to be solution-based, strength-based thinking in my approach. And how do we overcome this? How can we modify things? How can we make adjustments and make this work? So that's sort of, I guess that's where that mindset comes from too. You know, I always say to people, we have an inherent ancestral strength and resiliency, and we need to remember that and continue that today.
You know, it's interesting. You said you fell off the wagon. I mean, I think it takes a lot of us, right? You have to, and I think that's what people need to hear too, because people might look at you and say, well, he's just different. You know, I fell off the wagon. He didn't, you know, you did fall off the wagon and you said, I'm going to self-correct. I don't know if you know or follow David Goggins. He fell off the wagon for a long time, you know, and he talks about that in his books, et cetera. And it's like we have a saying in business that, somebody told me when I was young, and it's fail fast. Like, make your mistakes early in life when you're young because you learn from it. It's more expensive, both health-wise from a business perspective, the older we get, right? So fail fast, learn from it, adapt and overcome. And so you know, that's I think that's important for people to hear, because I think sometimes I would look at somebody, you know, like you, people that are listening, they're going to go look you up and go, well, I'm just not as tough as Dosh. You know, he's a superhero, put you in a different light, because they're going to look at who you are today. And it's important that they hear that.
Yeah, I just put a bloopers reel on my Instagram today and I
I
got a
saw
bunch of response already, you know, showing
that.
people, hey, you know, if you're not stumbling, if you're not falling, if you're not failing, then you're not trying hard enough at anything in our life, you know? So I think it's important to go about our life for sure in a humble way. Yeah.
It's unfortunate. Last year, I didn't have a camera in my garage. I had the weighted vest on. I was doing weighted sprints. It was cold outside. The kids were playing, and they're going up and down the street. And I turned the treadmill on. Like, I think it goes to 15, and I see my daughter start to cross the street. And my brain, you know, doing too many things at once. So this treadmill's on a 15 incline at full speed, and I like try to step across it with a weight vest. And next thing I know, it's like blackout for a second. I face plant, spits me off the back. I don't even know where I am. I wake up on the garage floor. I've got blood coming out of my nose, out of my mouth, my both knees, because it basically it spun me on the back for a second because it was trying to get me off. And nose is instantly like crooked and swollen up. And they, oh man. But it's kids were like, well, you can't ever do that again. I was like, no, as soon as I heal up, I'm getting back on it. That's part of life. You know, you get bucked off, you got to get back on it.
Absolutely. And I had the same thing too with the treadmill. About 7 or 8 years ago, I was, you know, not as advanced in my, you know, training for sure, and I didn't know when to stop. But I was working with the trainer, and we were working on a cardiovascular endurance session, and he had a treadmill. We were doing intervals. I was doing something, kettlebell swings or something like that, or down dog push-ups, and then getting on the treadmill and going. It's getting faster and faster. And he said, "All right, stop when you need to. If this is too fast, don't jump on." I can do it. I jumped on, and right away that thing just spit me off and it shot me backwards, and I start rolling and tumbling. I wish I had that on camera. That's probably the funniest, you know, blooper that ever happened to me in fitness.
Absolutely. It's a humbling experience.
Yeah, we need those things to happen to us to humble us also, and to, you know, teach us to, you know, we learn a little bit more about our capabilities and a little bit more about our you know, our limits. You know, we need to know when we have those limits, right?
100%. So when are you out of the cast, and what are you going to be hunting this year? What are you going to get out and do?
So right now I'm only actually 2.5 weeks out from the day of injury, and next Wednesday I go in. They're gonna take the cast off. They're gonna do a scan, and they're gonna look at my X-ray and see if I'm on a good trajectory of healing. And if they are, they said I might be able to get in a boot or stay in a cast for another couple weeks. But so I want to take it easy and make sure it's healed, because, like I said, you know, right now it's over the counter deer archery season until I believe September 9th. I don't know if I'll make that. But so once that's out, I'm gonna be certainly, you know, getting back to, I'm gonna get out there. I'm gonna start glassing around. On our reservation, you know, we have our own hunting rules. So that's different and separate than the state. So the Arizona Game and Fish doesn't have any jurisdiction, you know, on our land. So, you know, I'm out there pretty soon. And because I'm pretty much almost out of wild meat, I'm gonna be out there at my rifle. To me, the goal is to just get some meat, you know, in the freezer. And so as soon as I'm out of this cast here, I might actually go out for a javelina this weekend, because, like, that's like we can find them on the flat ground. So I might go out and try to, grab one of those and make some sausage and stuff, and start getting some jerky going.
So I was down in Sonora back in, gosh, January, and I'd never eaten javelina. I'd been on some coal hunts down in Texas when I was younger, and I'd always heard the meat was terrible. And I've now seen some shows where guys cook it, and talking to the Mexican guys down there, and he was like, "I eat them all. It's great." And so he said the key, of course, is to get don't skin them immediately and stay away from the glands. And I was blown away. Nothing for anybody listening. People are like, "Oh, you doctored it." We took the tenderloin out. We put a little olive oil, salt, and pepper on a charcoal grill on the in the bush and grilled it, and it was fantastic. And I hear it's, "Oh, it's got to be doctored up in all these crazy ways." But if you skin, you make a good shot, you skin it immediately and stay away from the glands, the meat was great.
It's all about exactly a lot of people I've since hunting has gotten on social media. I'm so surprised to find out and see so many people that are talking about, oh, javelina tastes bad. You got to do this. You got to soak it in apple cider vinegar overnight or this and that. It's all about proper field care. If you can skin and gut without getting too much of the hair all over it, and of course avoid the gland, it's fine. It does have a different, it does have the so-called gamier taste than mule deer, than, but again, if you, it's great in chilies, it's great as pozole, it's great as tamales, it's great as sausage, jerky, it's not necessarily my favorite to eat like a steak, like I like, like a mule deer, but I do like it in those other ways. So that's what I would plan to do with it. And I always tell people too, if you can make the shot when the javelina is not aroused and excited, because when the hair stands up on its back, that's when it's secreting that gland and the hair that scent gets on the hair. And then if it gets on the meat, then your meat's gonna taste like that. But yeah, it's great if you do it right.
Just like when you make a bad shot and you get that adrenaline pump through an animal, and it's pumping those adrenal glands. And you, so you've got two daughters.
Yeah, I have two daughters. I have a Weston, and she's about to be 9 months, and I have Aloe, and she's three. So my wife and I are together, raising girls. I'm a girl dad. I'm not gonna have any more. If I was like in my like early 30s, we probably would have had more. But not that turning 40 is old. It really isn't. But how it is, raising children takes a huge chunk out of a certain part of your life that we want to raise them all growing up together too, and have that part. It was one journey.
I look forward to watching that journey because I know you're going to have them out and teaching them how to hunt, and that's going to be pretty special. I'll look forward to watching that journey over the next
yeah
several years.
I've already taken my daughter out on a couple of little outings to glass, and I had to carry her. I posted it that I was rocking Canis and everything. She has her little Canis Wolf, Raised by Wolf t-shirt. But I like carried her up the, up a glassing point, and it was a workout. And I thought, man, I'm glad I work out. I was telling her that, and she's like not even three, but you know how it is when your kids are that young. If you can take the kids out, then you can do whatever you want, because
That's
you can't be
right.
gone all day long when there's a
Just put her in
baby
that
at
Mystery
home.
Ranch pack and just carry her up.
Yeah, exactly. And we glassed around, and she knows what we're looking for. Like she's quiet, and I tell her, and she can see things. Like she's seen some wild horses before I did, and she's like, "Dad, Gavio, Gavio means horse," so when she goes out, when I shoot, the shoot, we shoot our bows in the back, her and my mom, her and myself and her mom, we shoot the bows. We got our deer target. She knows what it is. She knows what we're doing. She understands
That's
that.
awesome. Hey, I know people, as people listen to this podcast, they're going to go check you out and look at your exercises. You do a lot of different exercises. I love the creativity. Do you make a lot of those up? Is there something that you follow or?
Yeah, so a lot of the training I do is functional training. I don't have any trained certification or experience in that regard, but I've worked with a couple of different strength and conditioning coaches for quite a number of years, and then did my own research and learning, taken a few small courses online. But basically for me, for what's helped me is just understanding the basic movement, human movement patterns, which is you're pushing, you're pulling, you're lunging, you're hip hinging, squatting, rotate, and then your gait, and then learning about the different energy systems, such as training for power, training for strength, training for endurance, total body endurance, muscular endurance, you know, doing mobility and learning the difference between mobility and flexibility. So I try to cover all those bases when I'm training. And I love a lot of the unconventional tools. I've been working with kettlebells now for about 11 years, steel mace for about 7-8 years. And I just love them because the versatility of those tools, there's so much you can do. There's just so many movements to do with the kettlebell. And of course I have dumbbells. I have, you know, my bars, my hex bar, you know, all of that. My battle ropes, my slam balls, my, you know, heavy medicine bags, all of these tools for myself. Like, there's so many possibilities of putting together a circuit. If you want to gain size, or if you want to gain, you know, overall endurance, or if you are trying to gain strength, man, the possibilities are just endless. If you understand a little bit of the mechanisms of the body and putting together circuits, generally my whole approach is every circuit is made up of 3 to 4 workouts, and I complete those back to back 3 or 4 times to make one circuit. And then of course there's like 60 second rest, 30 second rest. If I'm training for strength, I allow, you know, 1.5 to 2 minutes of rest in between, you know, big lifts. If I'm training for endurance, I'm doing, you know, 10 second rest, 15, 30 second, you know, and that's what I like to do. I try to cover all those bases, and I try to be as versatile as possible. I try to have speed, you know, I try to train sprinting. I try to have endurance. I try to have strength. I like to have power. I used to train in mixed martial arts a little bit, so I love to have kick power, punch power, those things as well. And I'm also thinking about being out, you know, on the desert terrain. And when I'm out there, I'm programming in my mind, what is it that I find myself doing most when I got, you know, a pack on me, 70, 80, 90 pounds, you know, of a packed out animal in this. What are the movements I'm doing? I'm always lunging, and you need like hip mobility. You need glute stability, core stability from when you're those split seconds or seconds when you're on one leg. But you also need mobility, being able to kind of lift up your leg, even when you're making a stalk, right? Like, you need to be able to lift up, you know, your leg. And thankfully the Canis pants are nice and quiet. But getting over a dry, brittle brush in the Sonoran Desert, you have to have mobility, you know what I mean, to move it over. I find myself sort of thinking and evaluating, what is it I'm doing in the field, and what do I need to do in the gym to train to make this, you know, movement smoother and stronger. So that's really my approach, is just training for life. You know, I'm training for everything that life puts at us, everything from working on the land to farming to hunting to self-defense, all of that kind of stuff. And just being a strong dad, carrying my daughters while I got this walking device on, has been no problem. You know?
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned the mobility, stability and mobility. You know, I've seen guys, especially like sheep hunting up in the steeps, or elk hunting in the steeps, or goat, whatever guys may be hunting, or mule deer. It can be scary anyways, right? But when I've really seen fear really start taking over people's minds is when they don't have that mobility. So they've lost their body's telling them, you're not strong enough to be on one leg up here. And then the fear, the downside is that you're going off that mountain 2,000 feet or whatever that may be, or even, you know, 50 feet. And then the fear goes back to their brain, and it's like telling it like you shouldn't be up here, and now their legs don't work. And that's a scary thing. And so, that's what I've found. We used to think, I used to think core, not being educated, you know, it's like, oh, do a bunch of sit-ups, do abs. I've learned hunting in the mountains, it's just as much or more lower back as well, because if they're both not strong, you're not going to have stability and mobility.
Absolutely.
And as you mentioned, you throw that pack on, and then that's a whole other game changer.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that, you know, in addition to the elements, you know, it could be cold out, or it could be warm, you know, you could be really hungry, you could feel thirsty, you know, for sure. I would certainly, you know, encourage, you know, guys that are looking to get in shape is yes, you should be squatting, you should be lunging, work the legs unilaterally, individually, train individual leg strength by lunging, a variety of lunging, reverse lunges, a split squat, and then of course, so have your lunging, have your core stability and strength like you're talking about. Have your glutes firing for sure, and being able to understand posture, I think, is really important. Like when you throw on, say, like, the Mystery Ranch pack is awesome because it makes 80 pounds feel like 40, 50, the way everything cinches down the hip belt. I use the Sawtooth. So I throw that on and I ride it up a little high so it's way above my hips. So I don't feel the strain on my hips when I'm packing out. I feel it on my glute, and I can tilt forward with like a neutral spine and walk. And I'm feeling it on my glutes. I'm feeling it on my quads and my hams where I want it, because those are the big muscle groups that you want those to be firing when we're hiking up hills, going down hills. You want your quads firing as you're going down, So I would encourage hunters, yes, work your lunging movements, do stuff to get your glutes to be firing, and of course, train that cardiovascular endurance, that muscular endurance as well. So, set a timer for 5 minutes and you're doing stepping up and down, with your pack loaded up, and get used to that breathing and learn to breathe. Big breath in the nose, big, exhale out the mouth as well, taking that oxygen,
How is Josh, how is How's the interest right now in hunting on the res? You've got your program. I know you're educating people. You're hunting on the res. Is there a lot of interest? Is it busy? Would you like to see more people on the res getting out and taking advantage of those
But
opportunities?
yes, the interest is there, and I would say that there are some people. I hear about it. I talk to some people. It would be good for sure to see more people from the community in the res getting out to hunt, even if it's really just hunting the small game in some of our open space areas, a preserve, hunting the rabbit, hunting the quail, and hunting the javelina. We have an abundance of those as well. So it would be good certainly to see that, as well as seeing more people forage like the seasonal plants. Like the springtime, we have cactus buds, cholla buds that we harvest around March, April. And then there's a variety of tree beans throughout the year. We just passed the sorrel cactus fruit, which is our new year. That usually happens in like late June, early July. It would be good to see more people for sure getting out there and hunting. I would love it if, because our land where we do hunt for mule deer, for javelina, is a little bit limited. There certainly isn't enough herds to, to sustain the more people out there doing that. So that's sort of like the challenge right there. I would love it if the state somehow, the Arizona Game and Fish, would work with the different tribes who don't have a lot of land to hunt on, to allow some sort of allow it easier for people to get drawn. Because there it that is our ancestral territory, even though it's technically off the reservation. It's, the land that's just outside of our res, Unit 22. That's area where our ancestors roamed, and I can't hunt it because the state has control of it. And there's a case to be made, there's a case to be made, and that's the case where a lot of Native people, their reservation is small and they don't have land to hunt, and they got to participate in the game, lottery. And it could take 10 years, in Arizona can take you 15, 20 years to get drawn for bison, I hear. It could take years to get a coveted elk tag. That's why I'm settling for a cow tag. I said, for me, I can't eat antlers. I'm looking for the meat. All I need is
That's
the
right.
meat. That, you know what I mean? And all I need is the,
Absolutely.
It's like, what is he, Rutt Daniels says? He says, everyone's looking for inches. I'm looking for ounces.
That's right.
And so, I'll stick with the cow tag because I could, I'm gonna be able to. I want the meat. That's what I'm looking for. But to get drawn for a bull elk, man, and the rut could take years. And anyone will tell you that that's been trying to apply in Arizona. So, yeah. And getting back to, my initial subject is that, a lot of Native people are at disadvantage like that. I would love it if somehow the Game and Fishes would say, okay, you're gonna have another. We're going to have another draw for Native people. This is your ancestral territory, I guess, sort of out of good faith. There's no law that says that they have to do that, but that would allow more Native people to get back and be hunting on their ancestral territories. That was land that was illegally seized at different points in time in history, is really what it is. That's there's that's stated there, you know, even within the parameters of law, you know, and a lot of our people have had our land illegally seized. So I think that that would make it easier for more people, more native people, to get out to be hunting again their ancestral hunting grounds.
Well, and I think we've summed it up today, just in our own personal lives. If more people are out hunting, they're into that circle. And that circle, as you said, it's got seven pieces. A lot of these things, and that kind of goes in line with the work that you're trying to do and help people through, you know, that you've seen through your own struggles. Being out hunting is going to take care of a lot of that stuff. And it's going to allow people to once you're in it, to appreciate those seven different factors that you
I
mentioned.
would also encourage non-Indigenous hunters out there to acknowledge too, even within their own mind, the land in which they're hunting upon. Who was the original inhabitants of this land that hunted before us? Because a lot of there's a big narrative out there of, you know, public land in this land right here is, you know, it's that's a part of this freedom narrative, but that's only been for a certain faction of people in this country. It didn't go for native people. So I would encourage a lot of non-Indigenous folks too to even within their own mind acknowledge the land in which they're hunting upon, and how can you support Indigenous, you know, hunting efforts as well. There's an account called Hunters of Color on Instagram that are doing great work in this regard, and I would encourage a lot of non-Indigenous hunters to think about that and to at least acknowledge the land and acknowledge that native people been hunting the elk here, the Hawaii, the Kuri Hawaii, the mule deer for, you know, centuries, and but yet we've been removed from that, and that's been taken from us in a certain to a certain degree. So I think that that's always something, you know, people can understand and be mindful of when they're on the land, and it might prompt them in the future to help with efforts, you know, to support Indigenous food sovereignty or Indigenous hunting once again.
I was out in far west Texas, you know, down along the Mexican border, and also, you know, in areas of New Mexico. And I've got friends that have sent me pictures of the paintings inside the caves from, gosh, who knows how long ago. And it's paintings of elk inside the caves with a campfire and a scene, a hunting scene. And so, I mean, it's just, I'd love to go back in time and sit there and that's what you're getting at. You know, people have been hunting elk for millions of years, right? And or and
Yeah,
whatever that
absolutely.
timeline looks like, but for a very long time. Well, you know, we're about out of time here. But first of all, I encourage anybody listening, go check out Thosh's Instagram page, look at the exercise. I'm sure he'd be happy for you to reach out on your own personal journeys as far as training for hunting, because you obviously it's very inspiring and you know, lots of creativity in your workouts. That's what I love. I found that I feel like in the best at 39, the best shape of my life because I've listened to my body and I've gotten creative with my exercises and decided what makes me feel strong. And it's getting creative. I've got the bag to done a little bit of Krav Maga, wish I had time to do that every day. But even just doing it for a short time taught me like other exercises that I can add to my regimen. So check Thosh out. Thosh would love to have you on again at some point, and love to ideally go on a hunt together someday. It'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah, man, I'd love that. You know, I welcome everyone to come check out my page, you know, and socialize with me on social media. That's why I got on, was really to connect with people. But thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate and I'm honored that you guys felt that, you know, I was interesting enough to come on and share a little bit about, you know, my hunting journey. And like I said, it's such an honor. It's awesome to be a part of the Canis team and to be a part of the brand in there, these sort of earlier stages. To me, that's awesome. And I look forward to growing with the company, with the brand. And Canis is all I wear, you know, when I'm out, you know, out on the land, that's all I wear. I don't have any other brands anymore. I gave them away. So I got so much Canis gear already, and I look forward to going on a hunt, man. Next time you guys are going down to Sonora, I would love to join on that hunt for some big Sonoran mule deers or, you know, bighorn sheep.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the decision was pretty simple for us. It's, you know, Canis is a, it is a, it is a brand, it is a technical apparel company. You know, for product development, we want to push the envelope. We want to live that lifestyle that goes into every single product that we make. At the same time, we think it can be a lot more than that. We want to motivate people to live their best life, right? And that's when we came across you, you fit that mold. It was a pretty simple decision to have you on. So look forward to watching your journey. I hope people check you out, and we'll have you back on at some point and catch up again.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Right. Thanks so much.